This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 25th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 177, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Today, we'll be meeting Robert Greene, the US author whose books on power, how to get it, and how to master it have made him the go-to man for those looking for success at any cost. We'll find out if he's really as mean as he sounds.
And we'll also hear from a legend of the art world, Sir Peter Blake, and finding out why, after 50 years of making iconic pop art, he's still creating exciting new work.
We'll also find out whether China's population is truly able to enjoy the country's meteoric economic growth, and take an historical trip through the eyes of infamous assassins.
That's all to come, plus the week's news agenda, and I dare say some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's that old devil called the Monocle Weekly again. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, we're back together again.
Aren't we? It's been an up and down, it's been a stormy sea the last month or two. I won't mention the phrase the horse draws, but this show's been up and down like a something, hasn't it? There's been all sorts of different hosts, and it's nice to be back in the hot seat.
Yes. Have you been around?
I've kind of been around, but I've been slightly heady this week. Not heady as in terms of like being on a roller coaster of a week. You know when you kind of get that sort of slight November, you might call it November blues. Not just because we're dressed in uniform blue as ever, Andrew, but you know when you get those weeks.
Yes, you don't feel as chirpy as your usual self.
I've been doing that thing which is never quite as pleasurable as it sounds, which is working from home a bit this week, cranking out bits of Alpino, trying to remember through the vodka haze what I did in Siberia, so we can write it down for Alpino, which we're putting to bed. Looks good, doesn't it?
I like Alpino. It's kind of one of those surprises in a big format. And it's just
nice. It's a surprise. You're like, oh, I've got to do that as well.
Well, it is almost. It's like, oh my God, there's that newspaper again. And then it kind of sneaks up on you. And it's just funny seeing something so big format when you open those spreads and they're giant.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a good prelude this year because we are going to be going up to the mountains. Monocle 24 is going to be in St. Moritz over New Year live. So if you're heading that way, come and see us. We'll give you a glue vine.
Me?
Yeah, well, anyone. Well, I don't think you're going. I know that you're not heading that way.
You're I'm going. Yeah,
you're going somewhere else.
I'm going somewhere else. Somewhere less snowy, I think.
And I think you've got a nice. Have you got potentially a Middle East trip between here and Christmas?
I am. I'm going to rock the Casbah.
You're going to Beirut, aren't you?
I'm going to Beirut. I think that's possibly. Everyone will write in and say that's North Africa.
Well, it's not North Africa at
all. It's not North Africa. No, the Casbah, mate. The Casbah.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, I'm going to go to Beirut. I think I'm going to try and tease that trip out a little bit. But I know we've got all sorts of kind of stuff to get into. We've got Christmas fairs, haven't we, in Midori House? We've got a number of things where someone's going to have to dress up as Santa and someone's going to have to dress up as an elf. Andrew will toss a coin for it.
Well, unfortunately, due to height restrictions, I will probably be given the elf job. But the only good thing is that there's Steve Bloomfield always in these moments of crisis.
Well, exactly. He's always there when you need him.
Steve,
cool rank, Andrew.
Steve, no, I'm taller than you, Bloomfield. Oh, no, you're not me. That's the Christmas market, which is at Midori House, and the whole world is invited. So come down and see us on the 1st and the 2nd. You can pat an elk. And that's not a euphemism.
I don't think we need any further introduction to that.
No.
That sounds like when is it, Andrew?
The 1st and 2nd of December. That's a Saturday and a Sunday.
Okay. What have we got on today's show? It's a good show. We've got Robert Greene. He's going to be talking about Mastery. That's a book.
And it's intriguing. We'll ask him about it. But his book is apparently one of the most read books in US prisons.
And we'll be talking about assassins, as you said in the introduction there. I'm kind of intrigued to see how that pans out.
We're going to be biting the bullet.
Right, without further ado, and coming up next, I think, we're going to have Tom Edwards with his news agenda. I can hardly wait.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
And as promised, Tom Edwards has joined the fray.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you both on this fine Sunday?
You look very good, Tom. You've had your hair cut.
I'm all right. In answer to that question, I'm all right. And then Andrew.
I've just noticed you've had a bit of a trim.
I like to keep myself looking spick and span.
Yes.
I'm just going to inspect that.
What do you request when you go into the barbers?
For something that doesn't look too much like a haircut.
Okay.
And they've certainly succeeded.
Yeah, I wandered into that one a little bit.
You did a bit. That was an underarm slow ball outside the leg stump, really.
Driven out of the whole stadium.
Exactly.
By Robert Brown.
Well, well-groomed Edwards. Where are you going to start with the news preview for the following week?
I thought we'd start with tomorrow. Now, this is a kind of story that's been rumbling on. It's quite interesting. Tomorrow, the body of Yasser Arafat is being exhumed by French criminal investigators in cooperation with scientists from Switzerland, Radiation Physics Department at Lausanne University Hospital. And this was made possible after various demands, a lot of suspicion, certainly amongst some within Arafat's camp, amongst the Palestinians.
How did he die?
That he had been poisoned. Lots of claim and counterclaim. It's been a sort of long and intriguing story. And they finally got permission from the sort of Palestinian president to go ahead with this. And that's what's going to happen. And then they'll do more advanced screening, this kind of thing, to try and get to the bottom of what happened to him.
Because he ended up in France because his wife has French nationality, is that correct? Or
that's right, but I think it's more to do with I'm not sure whether that's where they sort of registered their complaint. I think because they just thought it would have more traction there and there'd be more likelihood of getting a thorough and comprehensive sort of analysis completed.
When's that happening, Tom?
Intriguing. That's happening tomorrow. Tuesday. This is very intriguing. There's the International Symposium on Looted Nazi Art.
Oh, brilliant. This is
taking place on Tuesday. Now, it's the 10th anniversary of the Dutch Restitutions Committee, which is an advisory body that organises this symposium. And they're looking at alternatives to litigation in terms of settling these disputes. And there have been a few quite high-profile ones recently with some particularly interesting works. I think there was a Vasily Kandinsky that was sold or up at auction recently that had been the subject of one of these disputes. And it's just very interesting that they're trying to look for these to sort of broker solutions rather than going through all the expense of the courts. But it's a really kind of complex and interesting area. Obviously, a lot of the artists who tend to feature most often are many of those who were sort of labelled the degenerates, you know, by the Nazis during
they were put in Swiss vaults or they were stolen from Russian houses, literally. Yeah.
It's fascinating. I mean, there were some terrible stories, even of some of the works, I think, as it wound down during the darker latter days of the Second World War, even destroyed some of these works. I think some people sort of panicked, what are we going to do with them? It's all going to come out. And they actually ended up defacing them all, destroying them all together, which is obviously heartbreaking. Some of the most high-profile people like Marc Chagall, Otto Dix, Kandinsky, Paul Klee, who were often featured on the sort of real hit list of the most dangerous, I guess, because they were slightly more contemporary than
the old
masters.
And they were Jewish artists.
Yeah. So really interesting. It'd be interesting to see if they can come up with something that delivers better.
Well, it's kind of like it's always a good day for the insurers, but a really complicated day for everyone else trying to, and the value of things that are insured as opposed to the value of a Chagall or a Kandinsky, massively valuable, obviously, that sells at auction. They're always insured for far, far, far less. So it's a really, really interesting thing as well. It's kind of a check and a measure on the art, the craziness of the art world too.
Should I jump in?
That was good. That was interesting.
That's interesting. Okay. What about on Thursday? This is a slight bit of a kind of media story. Don't want to be too inward looking, but I think it's a day worth noting. The first part of the Leveson Inquiry, which is this report into the culture, practice and ethics of the British press, is released on the same day as Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks will appear in court. They, of course, are two of these top media executives who've been charged under this Operation Elvedon, which is looking into the sort of criminal elements of this. And that part, the really juicy part of the Leveson Inquiry, won't be published for some time because they need to let all these cases go through the courts. But this is just about the kind of culture and ethics of the press, and I think it will be interesting.
So Leveson will be making his recommendations to the press, or to the government, or to the, or just public.
Yeah, well, it should include general recommendations about regulation in particular, which is obviously what the main focus has been. It's too self-regulated. It clearly hasn't worked in a number of instances. And this will have general recommendations in terms of regulation.
Well, that's something you'll be covering. We'll be covering here on Monocle 24, I'm sure, in depth.
Absolutely.
They'll be telling you to put the lid on your pen, probably, Tom. Thank you very much, as ever, for your news roundup. Coming up next, we'll have our first guest. Welcome back to The Weekly. If you believe in the old adage, nice guys finish last, then it means we may still be here recording The Weekly until next Sunday. But our first guest is an American author who's made something of a career from books encouraging dominance, mastery, and above all, the pursuit of power.
Robert Greene is feted by power-hungry US rappers such as Jay-Z and 50 Cent, and his books are said to be some of the most popular in US prisons. His latest title, Mastery, takes an historical look at figures ranging from Charles Darwin to the boxer Manny Pacquiao to try and understand why humans crave success.
Robert, thanks for joining us on The Weekly. The book is Mastery.
Yes.
It's a good title, right? It reminds me of something else that came out this year.
What was that?
The Master.
Oh, the movie.
But that's all about cultishness, isn't it? And about it's about the kind of the magnetic power of one.
Right.
Mastery is a lot different to that, presumably.
Yeah, I covered the Master with My Art of Seduction and the whole the cult leader and the charismatic. This is a different book. This is a little more serious. This is a book about people who've been pursuing a line, a field of, or subject, and they go so deeply into it that they have almost occult-like intuitive powers, a Napoleon, a Leonardo da Vinci, but then I profiled nine of these contemporary masters as well.
And the idea of mastery is not only mastering yourself, but mastering other people, isn't it? So it's a kind of, it's a double-edged sword. And there are twin peaks, indeed, on the cover of your book.
Yes.
So it's about yourself and it's about others, isn't it?
Well, it would be three peaks, really. It would be about yourself and others and the field that you're trying to conquer.
That's a crown.
That's the crown. Wow, you've got it all figured out.
I'm going to design your next book. We'll have a chat after the show.
I've never really been questioned in this way about the iconography of the book. Well, in the process of learning a field really well and going through an apprenticeship, I maintain that you do actually master yourself. You learn how to be patient, how to be disciplined, how to focus. I maintain that we don't really realize the full potential of the brain, and the brain is this insanely wonderful instrument that if you learn to focus it on something deeply and think about it deeply enough, all kinds of aspects of its reality will reveal itself to you. So in the process of getting this power of mastery, you do end up mastering yourself. You do end up mastering your field. And you will master other people to a certain extent. And I have a chapter in there on social intelligence and the importance of knowing how to work with people and knowing how to protect yourself against those nasty manipulative types that exist out there.
And Robert, the kinds of people that you've kind of marshaled together for this book, you know, on the face of it, some people might be, you know, not sure how you linked them all together, but what was it for, you know, for the likes of Charles Darwin, for example? What was it about him that appealed to you as a writer and as a character? Mm-hmm. What made you think these were people, more than anyone else in the field of, say, science, that had been the real masters?
Well, first of all, I think Charles Darwin is the most exceptional scientific master ever, because I believe the theory of evolution is going to have the greatest impact on our future. It's totally redoing all of the sciences. In the end, it may have a greater impact than anything that Einstein came up with. But I love the story of Charles Darwin. I was really drawn to it because I'm sort of personally intrigued by people who overcome obstacles, don't really have, don't have a silver spoon. I mean, Darwin came from a rather wealthy family, but he seemed like a lost soul. His father was really worried about him. He didn't like school. He wasn't a good student, and nobody knew what would become of him. And so he had this opportunity to take this incredible adventure around the world on the HMS Beagle when he was a young man. And it was a very risky decision on his part. It was an unpaid position. It was dangerous. And he didn't know what would come of it. And it really wasn't a career he was intending to follow. And I just love the journey that he went on this voyage, and how he went from being this kind of snooty son of a doctor to becoming this insane adventurer in South America who accumulated all this information that eventually the theory of evolution came to him. So I'm a collector of weirdos, of people who are strange and different, and I'm attracted to them, and that's who I like to write about.
We'll talk about some of your other books in a little while, but in these characters, are you also trying to, as Rob was touching on the beginning of the show, are you also trying to uncover something that's inspirational for the person reading it? Almost,
yes.
You know, we can't all be Charles Darwin, obviously, but do you think there's something in his tale that is a narrative that we can pick up on?
Well, most definitely anybody can be Charles Darwin, because what's so interesting about his story is that he was not seemingly very gifted as a boy. People didn't think he was a terrible student. and no one knew what he would become. And the story of Darwin is about sheer persistence. He, after he discovered or came up with a theory of evolution and returned back to England, he spent the next 30 years of his life basically in his house outside London, spent accumulating more and more evidence so that he could prove the theory of evolution. It's simply the story of a man who was incredibly patient and persistent. He spent 8 years simply studying barnacles alone so that he could show that barnacles would fit into his theory of evolution. It was an incredibly tedious task that he assumed then. And so it's the story of somebody overcoming the tedium and finding a way to be excited about it. I think it's incredibly inspiring and exemplary.
And one of the other things, we talk about apprenticeships quite a lot in mm-hmm. Monocle magazine, certainly. Oh. And they're a chapter in your book, aren't
yes.
they? And there's two sort of subplots to that, which is one which is sort of reinvent your inferiority, not complex, yes. but reinvent your inferiority. That's yeah. quite a good thing, to be the person snapping at someone else's feet. I think we'll stick
heat.
On feet, maybe.
Snapping
at someone's feet is yeah. presumably quite good to you. It's good to have, like if you're a distance runner, it's good to have a pace man out front, right?
Well, the metaphor that I come up with is that you're basically, you enter the world as a naive little foundling. You don't have the skills. You're ignorant. You don't know about people. And you're starting over. And this is reality. Reality is represented by this field that has existed hundreds of years before you. And people have accumulated rules and knowledge that you don't know. And so you have to, what I say, submit to this reality. I know it sounds like something in S&M or something, but you must submit.
We won't tell people what you're wearing. Right?
You must admit that you don't know things. Because if you feel like you know it, or that you want to get attention and charm people and that's the way ahead, then you're not paying attention. And this is a book about deeply paying attention to the people around you, to how others are getting ahead, to who's that master ahead of you, and what are the techniques that he or she uses. The more that you get rid of your ego and really deeply observe the people around you, then you're going to become a master. That's the game.
I was just going to say, Robert, in the research notes that we were given for you, before you visited us, your first book, 48 Laws of Power.
Yes.
What was amazing about that apparently it's been read by Fidel Castro. It's the
yes.
most requested book, apparently, in U.S. prisons.
Yes, it is.
Now, moving your readers from that all the way through to Charles Darwin, mm-hmm. is this the new book a diversion? And perhaps you should just tell us a little bit about that starting point book. Why did that become such a phenomenon?
Well, the book grew out of it's my first book, and I had previously been working in Hollywood, and I was not a happy person working in Hollywood. And basically, I found it kind of a hypocritical environment where people would pretend that everything was lovely and wonderful, and they loved your movie, and you're the best writer and the best actor. But behind the scenes, they were the most nasty, manipulative people you'd ever meet, doing all kinds of incredible power moves. And so I was inspired because in my experience in the work world, there are people out there, particularly in business, who can be very manipulative, very tricky, and no one talks about it, no one writes about it. And the naive little people like myself who enter the work world are inevitably screwed by these more sharper types. So I wanted to reveal to the world all of the laws of power that these people use, that I use and other people. Not all of the laws are necessarily nasty. Some of them are about how to seduce and charm people. The metaphor I use is that you're like a court. It's like an aristocratic court. Your field is filled with kings and princes and dukes, and they all have their egos, and you have to know how to charm them and win the favor of the king. And it's a metaphor that seemed really appropriate at the time, and it really resonated with obviously people in business. And then for some reason it resonated with hip-hop artists, and I became really popular with 50 Cent and Jay-Z. I went on to write a book with 50 Cent. It became popular with people in prison, artists, filmmakers. I don't think there's anybody who hasn't in some way resonated with. But I'm at a different moment in my life, and what I was seeing now in the zeitgeist was a lot of people who don't understand something basic about life, which is what really matters is that you're good at what you do. You actually bring results. You actually solve problems. You actually are creative. It's not just a game of politics. So that's the new book that I wanted to write.
And you talked about sort of Darwin's persistence.
Yes.
This is the kind of thing when you might be a genius or you might be very hardworking, but I guess it's bringing it to the attention of others, because there's a lot of things when you read the biographies of lots of people that have made it, whether they're rock stars or whether they're film producers, whether they're scientists, they've got to have wanted to be in the right place at the right time as well as being in the right place at the right time.
Right.
Is that something that's a kind of string through your book as well?
Yes. I mean, I talked a lot about that with 50, oddly enough, when I was doing the book with him, because he would always claim that there was almost like an ambition gene that he had, that he always felt when he was
younger. Get rich or die trying was his record, right?
That's right, yeah. He almost felt from an early age that he was incredibly driven and that there were other people who were hustling on the street, dealing drugs like he was, who just weren't driven to get out of it. And he said that he got it from his mother, who was murdered when he was like 8 years old. And he said she was this incredibly ambitious woman and whatever. I don't know if I buy that there's some kind of gene about that, but I do make the point in Mastery that everybody is born with the material to become a master. It's hardwired into the human brain. I'm not going to go over that now, but I lay it out in the book pretty clearly. But it's true that you have to want it. You have to feel the need for this kind of power. You have to be somewhat ambitious and really driven and excited by what you're doing. So maybe not everybody has that.
And Robert, did that always stick with you at an early age? Were you the kid who was like 5, 10 years old, wondering why was that person more successful and why were they getting ahead? Are these books born out of your life story?
Well, a little bit. I was always sort of interested in games and sports and chess and games of strategy. And I wasn't interested in, like, who won. I was interested in how they won. So if I was watching basketball, I was really interested in the strategy and the coach and the mind behind it, the man who was moving all the pieces and figuring out the strategy, because to me that seemed like what was really happening. It isn't about stars and athletic prowess. It's about the strategy, and so I've always been obsessed with it. But really, it was my experiences in the work world, because I once tried to count. I probably have had 80 different jobs in my life. And seeing the work world from journalism, from film, from television, from academia, I see all of these power games that people play, these little courts, and they fascinate me. And I want to know and uncover the dynamic behind them.
And not necessarily pointing, not putting these two things next to each other and putting too fine a point in it, but having 80 jobs and the word failure is a thing, though, isn't it? Because failure is presumably the thing that it kind of forms our instinct. Doing something 69 times and you get it right on the 70th makes it perfect on the 70th time, I presume.
Well, by the 80th job, I think my parents thought I was a failure, and I maybe was getting close to that. But a writer is always... Your apprenticeship as a writer is trying different things and having experiences. And, you know, I lived all over the world and I just tried everything. And I even tried my hand at writing journalism in Hollywood and it wasn't right. And then I finally hit on the right thing. So the moral of the story is that you don't lose faith. I never totally lost faith. I knew someday I would sort of find the right medium for myself.
And I was just going to say there's a bit of an echo then with Mr. Darwin.
Yes. I'm not putting myself in this gallery.
What he's saying is, Robert is saying that studying barnacles for 8 years is like working in Hollywood, right? For the time being, Robert Green, author of Mastery. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you so much for having me.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co, and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
We're going to have a song now, Andrew.
What are we going to have?
We've let the lunatics overtake the asylum slightly today. Jack Phillips, of world renown, of Monocle renown at least, has chosen this one. This is one of his favourites. You might have heard it on the Atlantic shift.
What is it?
Another shift. It's called Pato Fu, and it's by a band called Made in Japan, who obviously are a Brazilian rock band. Take it away.
Made in Japan. Made in Japan. Made in Japan.
And that was Pato Fu by Made in Japan. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be meeting a pop art legend just after this. And you're back. British icon Sir Peter Blake is that rare thing, an artist whose presence captures the spirit of a whole cultural movement. Blake's pop art was the first to bring a fun, disposable sensibility to the surly post-war British art scene in the 1950s, and he's still very much active today. This week, his latest exhibition, entitled Rock, Paper, Scissors, opened in Mayfair's Waddington Cousteau Galleries. Monocle's David Pleasant met Blake at the gallery to learn why the art world will never tire of pop.
I think the road I've taken is the road I wanted to take, but it's also a cross I have to bear. I mean, you know, that because the work is very diverse, I think I'm sometimes read as a kind of light artist. But that's fine. That's the road I've taken, and it still contains an enormous interest in popular culture, and certainly in pop music. I mean, only this month I've done a cover for Madness, their new album, and I've done a cover for Paul Weller, who brought out a CD of songs last year, and he's taken one song called Firefly. And I've done as a single, and I've done the cover for that. So I'm still involved in the pop world, very much involved.
She's like a dragonfly with no fire.
When you started your career some 60 years ago, and where we are now, what do you think? We're in a better position or worse position? I mean, can you make any kind of comparison? What do you feel now?
When people have asked me what's the difference between American pop art and British pop art, I think a lot of American pop art was cynical.
Is that because of post-war feeling and there was kind of drawing in American influences in a more kind of wholehearted, kind of celebratory way, as you've kind of described?
Well, I think, let's take Lichtenstein as a case. My theory about Lichtenstein is that he was right at the end of the abstract expressionist movement, and what he really wanted to be was an abstract expressionist. And he did one painting for his son, and it was either Andy did one and Lichtenstein did one. One was Popeye and one was Mickey Mouse. Let's say Lichtenstein did the Popeye, and he showed it to Leo Castelli, who liked it very much and sold it and pretty much said, can you do some more? So from then on, he did comic book pictures. And towards the end of his life, opened it up much more to be about art. But my theory is that he didn't like comic book pictures, and I don't think he actually liked making those Ben-Day-Dot pictures. So he was cynical to make them and became very rich.
But whereas you enjoyed, you savoured the kind of pop culture.
It should be one of the reasons to work is to make magic, and in this case, to make people smile.
It was 20 years ago today. Sergeant Pepper taught the band to play. They've been going in and out of style, but they guaranteed to raise a smile.
Obviously, the Beatles cover that you did is probably your most iconic image. But how do you think that influenced everything that came after it, of that era of Britain's history and how it's represented now? Do you think it's, you know, has it been bastardized or morphed into something it wasn't?
I mean, in terms of making a piece of art, what it actually is a crowd of people. And 20 years before that, I'd made images with crowds of people. So it's one. It's one crowd among many. I mean, there are lots of crowds in this show. So on one level, it's about a crowd. What was magical about it was that because of the way we made it, it could be a crowd of anybody ever. I mean, it could be, for a while, Jesus was in there, I think, but it could be anybody. So that was the magic of it. I'm cynical about it because I was paid very little for it, so the cynicism comes in there. But I mean, in terms of part of your question, I mean, for instance, the Stones coming back and doing tour now. I always say, why not? You know, I mean, they're old, but they still make great music. There's no, when they started, you like Pete Townsend singing "Hope I Die Before I Get Old," and people assuming a band would go on for 5 years. There's no reason why it shouldn't go on for 50 years if they're still playing great music and writing great music.
If I said to you that you maybe created modern Britain, or the visually modern Britain, what, how would you react if I said that?
It has to be thought a part of that. You know, I mean, Chrissy called down yesterday morning and said that Rose had just called and said on Six Music they just said Peter Blake is a god. So that was a nice start to the day. And it's nice to have reached the age I have and be venerated and feel part of all that. So I'm happy with that. In some of the very earliest pieces in the late 40s and 50s, I used an image of the Union Jack in a patriotic way. And about 8 years ago now, I did a series of prints called Found Art, and one was a tiny little cloth Union Jack, which I scanned and printed up to like 6 feet tall. And the technology of it was that it, as it got bigger, it got clearer. So every thread showed up and every hair on the piece on the thread showed. But at the time, it was still quite kind of unacceptable to use a Union Jack. I mean, it had almost been claimed by the National Front as a badge. Now, I mean, London this year couldn't have been fuller of Union Jacks. So that's one quite nice thing, that it's acceptable to celebrate the Union Jack again.
Kind of trace you back to that, in a way.
In a way, I mean, I wouldn't claim the whole thing, clearly. But in a way, I was part of it. I think that was your question. I mean, I've always been incredibly patriotic and very much a royalist. You know, I stood in the crowd all night to see the Queen get married. You know, so I'm an old school patriotic royalist anyway.
And that was David Pleasant talking to Sir Peter Blake. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. All right, you're back with The Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be looking into China's economic future after this.
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Within the space of a couple of decades, China's ascent from closed communist society to economic superpower has seen wealth and prosperity become more attainable than ever before.
There's a lot of money changing hands, but how much of China's 1.3 billion population sees the benefits of big business? Gerard Lemos is a social policy specialist whose new book, The End of the Chinese Dream, Why Chinese People Fear the Future, aims to address the wealth gap in an economy soon to be the largest in the world. Monocle's Chris Fitch went to find out more.
The book is called The End of the Chinese Dream. So to start at the very beginning, what is, or possibly what was, the Chinese dream?
So I think in the early 1980s, everyone felt optimistic. Everyone felt they were part of this bright future, whether they were peasants and farmers or whether they were working in these new factories or whether, in fact, their life hadn't changed very much. They had this feeling that everyone was going to be a beneficiary. And that was the Chinese dream, and they wanted houses and jobs and pensions. But more fundamentally than those material things, they wanted a freedom from the sort of turbulence and insecurity that had been their experience all through the post-war era in China.
So this, I assume, is from kind of the embracing of capitalism. This is something that they thought was going to benefit them personally.
Well, the whole reform process, I mean, it was partly about economic reform, first in the countryside and then in these special enterprise zones. But it was also social reforms. You know, the more intrusive aspects of the Mao era were removed. You know, you didn't have to ask permission if you wanted to do things. You had a lot more social freedom. And particularly for young people, that felt great. You know, you could move around the country, you could go travel around China easily. Your whole world opened up, and China is a whole world, and suddenly you had all these opportunities, and some of them were material and economic, but lots of others were just about having fun, going out, meeting people, talking to people. And of course, that was inevitably accompanied by a huge artistic explosion, which in the so-called Beijing Spring, which was a fantastically culturally significant and politically significant movement in Beijing, but elsewhere too, in Chongqing, where I was working, of a new practice, new forms of artistic expression, some of them conceptual, some of them figurative. There was a complete cultural explosion, particularly in the visual arts, but also in areas like literature. And that was also part of the Chinese dream, I think.
But in your experience, you don't think it actually has turned out the way that people expected it to?
No, I think that's right. I think what's happened is that some people who hadn't benefited and thought they would found out in the 1990s not only that they wouldn't benefit, but that in many ways things got a lot worse, that reforms happened which removed some of the benefits they'd had before, removed some of the securities, and they could see that the new opportunities were opening up were opportunities that if you were, for example, a farmer migrating to the city, or if you were an old person that worked in a factory all your life, these were not opportunities from which you were going to benefit. So you felt like, people felt like they had become permanent outsiders. And that was a new experience, particularly in the context of communist propaganda and ideology, which said that we're all in this together, we're all building the utopian socialist future and so on. And suddenly to feel that there was huge momentum in society and you were not part of it was a new experience for Chinese people.
But of course, we've all heard the headlines that there are many people in China who are making millions and millions. So this must be an issue of inequality.
In part, China's a big country. And yes, there are lots of rich people in aggregate numbers. But as a proportion, there's still a hell of a lot of people living on low incomes without much security. And while China has made great strides in reducing absolute poverty, reducing starvation and so on, that's one of its principal achievements in the last 30 years. What it hasn't done is given people a feeling, not that they can have everything the rich people have, but that they've got a place in the future, and that place is a better place than where they are now.
And so from the people that you spoke to, how have the people who now feel left behind, how has this feeling that their dream is not going to come true, how does it manifest itself?
Well, some of the manifestations are in protests and so on, as we've seen reported, environmental protests and protests about land confiscation and so on, and that's been well reported. But there are other ways in which people express their dissent and their sadness, I suppose. Some ways are ways in which they turn in on themselves, they seek oblivion, if you like. They take drugs, they gamble too much, and, you know, they sort of give up. Suicide is more common and so on. But also, they find ways outside of themselves to express their dissents. And those dissents are expressed through ridicule and satire and comedy, all of which is burgeoning in China. But particularly, they express their dissents by gossiping a lot, by intrigue, and by being really quite disrespectful, which is a very un-Chinese way to behave.
And I understand that spirituality comes into this as well in your experience.
I think so. I think the evidence shows clearly that there is a great growth in spirituality in China, both traditional spiritualities, but also new forms and also Christianity. And I think that's something to do with seeking an explanation and seeking a moral compass and seeking some way of accepting, not perhaps understanding, but accepting what you're living through and coming to have more peace of mind, being more at peace with yourself.
And obviously China went through very significant reforms in the 1980s, as you were saying, but they weren't the only country to do that. So do you think what you describe in your book is something that is unique to China, or is it actually just a much larger scale of something that's happening across the world?
Well, China's been affected by globalization and foreign direct investment and so on, like a lot of other emerging economies. But I think many things that have gone on in China are uniquely Chinese. They're to do with the communist political system. They're to do with Chinese history and tradition. And I don't think that what's happened in China and the things that are still happening in China are the same as India or Indonesia or Turkey or Brazil. I think that's banal to compare those countries with their different histories. What they're all doing is their economies are growing faster than Western economies, at least in percentage terms, and that's pretty much all they have in common. I would say China is undoubtedly unique.
And finally, from your experiences being in China and talking to people, do people have hope that this is a situation that's going to change, or is it a relentless surge in one direction of massive inequality where a great number of people are left behind?
I have some hope. I mean, I can't generalize about all 1.3 billion Chinese people. I think there are things that the leaders can do, the government can do, which would re-engage people, which would rekindle people's sense of optimism. They could do something about the one-child policy. They could make it easier for people to move around from rural areas to urban areas, to the new cities. So there are things that they could do to make people's lives better. I don't feel entirely pessimistic about that. But what they really at the heart of it need to do is to make people feel they belong to China, both for now and in the future, and they have a real stake in the country and they're not left out and left behind.
That was Chris Fitch speaking to Gerard Lemos. Our final guest on the show today is Michael Newton. His new book, Age of Assassins, takes a look at the people who have shaped politics in the most extreme ways possible, by taking lives. Though it may not be pleasant to think about, the macabre infamy achieved by political assassins shapes history.
Newton has looked at the journeys leading up to some of these events to understand how political violence, that most of us regard as beyond reason, to a tiny minority becomes the only viable option. He joins us on the line now from Rotterdam. Michael, welcome to The Weekly. So Age of Assassins is the name of the book. Are we still in the age of assassins? I know this book has a sort of timeline to it. Maybe you can tell us sort of where it starts and finishes.
I guess assassination, like every other kind of crime, is always going to be with us. And the history of assassination, you know, goes back at least as far as Julius Caesar, and it has a great future ahead of it. When I came to write the book, one thing I realized was I would have to limit and select, and partly just on my knowledge. So it's basically European and North American. And also a kind of sense that it ought to tell a coherent story. It begins with Abraham Lincoln and ends with Ronald Reagan. And the reason for that is I wanted to begin with an American president shot by an actor in a theater while watching a play. And then to end with an attempt on Ronald Reagan, who had been a Hollywood actor, by somebody mentally ill who was committing the crime in order to impress a Hollywood actress. And it seemed to me, between those two things, there was a kind of strange parallel, and as well as a contrast. And in a way, that parallel and the contrast was the story I wanted to tell, or part of it at least.
It sounds like a fitting denouement from actor to actor, but I wanted to ask you about that. The idea of the assassin as an actor, whether they crave the notoriety and the fame of the people that they get rid of.
Absolutely. I think one thing I discovered in, you know, putting together all these different stories of assassination is how one assassin or one assassination kind of acts as a model or a role model for others. I think one reason why there's such a kind of a plethora of assassinations in America in the 60s and 70s was a sense that people wanted to imitate or play out the part of Lee Harvey Oswald. In that sense, in a way, kind of there is a kind of coherent history of assassination because one event leads to another. And I think they really were acting out roles, parts, a kind of image in their head. And at the same time, they were obviously affected by and kind of motivated by a desire to acquire or to sort of latch themselves onto parasitically the fame of their victims. In a way, there's a kind of one week in America in 1968 where within a couple of days, Sirhan Sirhan murders Robert Kennedy and Valerie Solanas shoots Andy Warhol. And I think really of the two events, in a way, the one that sort of was most prophetic or most pregnant with meanings for the 70s and thereafter was the Andy Warhol shooting, where the motivation really was quite simply a kind of a sense of envy towards fame and a desire to possess the victim's fame for yourself.
Michael, on the political assassination side, is it a very effective tool? You know, when you take out the one person that you're targeting, does the whole machinery around that person, you know, whether that's, you know, running an empire or whether that's being the head of state, does everything fall apart? Because what's interesting, I guess, is only in the last few days, we've seen very targeted attacks by the Israelis taking out a lead figure of Hamas, which preluded a little war in Gaza. We see, you know, stories again and again of, you know, why don't we take out this person? That would be the end of our problems. Is it a very good tool in the end, assassination?
There's two views. In a way, assassination depends upon the idea of the indispensable person. There's one character, one individual who, and if you could get rid of them, you would solve all the problem. It goes back to a sort of, I guess, a sense of the tyrant. There's this one man who, in a kind of isolated state, is oppressing and making life hell for everybody else. Get rid of them, it'll be okay. In a way, you could read the 60s assassinations in America in that way. By the time that Robert Kennedy and JFK and Martin Luther King and perhaps Malcolm X had gone, the next generation of politicians just looked less impressive. And in that sense, killing those people emptied the field. In another way, I mean, I think assassination is a very poor tool because you shoot the individual, but the office remains. I think there were often fantasies that if you get rid of Hitler, that would be an end to Nazism. I'm sure it would have had demonstrable and huge effects, but whether the Nazi movement would have ended with Hitler's death or whether, you know, it rapidly turned into a kind of martyrdom, it's unlikely that killing Hitler would have stopped the Second World War or changed very much, even though he, for instance, is such a central figure. I think kind of one thing that's odd about assassination is the sense that, in a way, kind of the efficacy of it ceased to matter. It didn't matter what happened. What mattered was performing an act, doing something. The sense that the murder itself was a kind of propaganda of the deed for the individual and for the movement, of which they were sometimes a part.
And I wanted to ask you, Michael, about the movements. I think one of the themes of the book is this sort of the decline of the American assassination, the decline in the ideology of it. Someone wanted to kill someone for an ideological reason, and then someone wanted to kill someone perhaps because they're a bit of a psychopath and they want to glory in the fame of it. Is this true? Do you see a decline in the quality of assassination?
I want to, in a way, but also not. I do point out at the conclusion to the book, in a way, the story that I'm telling in its last kind of quarter is an American story. And outside America, assassination for ideological reasons continued in exactly the same way as it had in the 1880s and 1890s and 1920s and 30s. You know, in Italy, in Germany, in Ireland and the UK, there are people who continued to assassinate and to terrorist acts, not for reasons of fame, but for ideological reasons, for party reasons. And in that sense, it's a kind of that's an American decline, and it's not really an international. However, having said that, one thing in a way that interested me was that the motivation for the kind of the lone assassin, the person who's trying to get out of a sort of a trap of anonymity and obscurity, is actually not that different from the motivation that's, you know, got operated within those parties, within those movements, within those ideologies. Both of them are kind of wanting to make an assertion of the self, of the individual, against the mass. And both of them, in a way, I think, were kind of also engaged in a sort of a self-erasure. You know, often assassination attempts are kind of suicide missions. And I think there is a sense that they want fame, but they also want their own end. And that was a curious discovery for me, that the motivation for the mad assassins is at least analogous to the motivation for the anarchists and the nihilists and the nationalists and the communists who are also performing assassinations in this period, psychologically speaking.
Michael Newton, author of Age of Assassins, A History of Conspiracy and Political Violence. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
When Sydney opera singer Adrian Tamburini isn't wowing audiences in his city's iconic opera house, he's outside enjoying its gorgeous surf beaches and magnificent harbour.
We have some incredible nature. Sydney, for example, is built around the water. There is water everywhere. There is sunshine. An outdoor kind of lifestyle is really important to us here in Sydney. And that reflects in the way we approach life.
There's nothing like Australia.
And that's it, isn't it, Andrew? 177 down. How many to go, I wonder? A million. An infinitesimal amount. Infinity. Can you draw an infinity? Should we draw an infinity on that paper? Should we get a new logo? What? You're not meant to be lost for words. What are you,
well,
come
no.
On.
It's been a bit... can I tell you...
Did you not like the show?
I thought it was I did like the show.
Good
very
guests.
Much. I thought that Mr. Green was very different from how I imagined he was going to be. I thought because he was like, so immersed in the kind of the rap world that, and his book is so much about power and yeah. kind of all these slightly aggressive things that he would be kind of less... He's much more cerebral and laid back than you, I imagine.
Yeah, he was. He was a nice man. He was chilled.
Yeah, really chilled.
I thought he was going to be coming out, giving me a little bit of the Patrick Batemans. Do you know what I mean? Like a power suit.
Yeah. But no, he was cool.
And I have to say, it sounds like the wrong thing to say. We've had Robert in. He's a very nice man. He's normally the authors of those sorts of books probably have a ponytail. Do you know what I mean?
And they're not very good. They're not very good or very powerful.
But Robert Greene, nice man. It looks like a good book. I like the design. It doesn't. It looks. It's got a sort of Ayn Randish kind of quality to it.
Somehow. Yeah, quite severe book covers. Yeah, but it's interesting. They are all kind of a type. So he's obviously trying to draw people onto the next book. But anyway, it's been a nice show, Mr. Robert Bound.
It's been nice, isn't it? It's good. It's good to be back in the studio, back in the cell with you, Andrew. We should thank our people that put this together, shouldn't we?
Off you go then.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips, also responsible for that wonderful song. We'll be back next week, but for now, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.